one of the beautiful things about sports is that you can sort of get off and get back on the bandwagon whenever you want. I know that everybody wears being a loyal, true fan as a badge of honor, but we see the attendance. There's certain games that get more people out. There's some events that get more people in out. It fluctuates. You get the casuals, the diehards. You get everybody to buy in. I was just at the last KU game. I'm just going to assume that there's fewer people tonight than there was. You're playing a worse opponent. It's close to the holiday weekend. Doesn't mean you're not a fan. You just ain't going. That's fine. That's the beautiful thing about sports. Hey, I'll catch the next game. Perfectly fine with that. Royals fans, sometimes you guys are tricky, and I know what you're trying to do. You don't want to get yourself hurt because you've been hurt before. If you believe and buy into the Royals and it doesn't work out, you'll be disappointed. But that's what sports fandom is. The Chiefs disappointed you for 30 years of your life. Eventually, it paid off, and now look at you. You've felt the confetti. You've seen the parades. You know what it's like to be a champion. I'm telling you right now. All it takes is for the Royals to win one of these kinds of series. They don't have to sweep the Tigers. But if they win this series against the Tigers, Nathan, and things kind of shake out, and we're talking about on Monday, the Royals are 2-1.5, one game back of the wild card. Football will be the biggest story on Tuesday when we all get back to work. But there will be excitement. There will be buzz about the Royals. There will start to be a feeling of, oh, they can do this. The Royals have to really give you a chance to believe. They got to give you a chance to dream a little bit. If they give you that chance, I think that the city will buy in. I think that the city will ride the wave, so to speak. But they got to give you that. And them beating up on the Nationals, that's not creating that energy. Them beating up on the White Sox is great. I think this team is going to finish over 500, back-to-back seasons of them finishing over 500. We got to be realistic. That's just not something the Royals have accomplished a lot in our lifetime. But if the Royals can just put together a couple of these series against the opponents that they have and start to change the narrative just a bit, because the narrative amongst the fan base is these aren't series that they think you can win. You can't beat the Tigers. You can't beat Toronto. You can't beat the Yankees. It's not realistic to think that you can win that. If they can do it, if they can prove it, I think you'll really start to see the shift and the energy change towards the Royals. It's always going to feel like this is the most important series that they have because of the stakes, because of everything that is at play. And I think a lot of people, I think the majority of people are somewhere in the same ballpark that I am. Hey, this team's certainly battled. They fought back. They're going to win 84, 85 games, and that's probably just not going to be enough in order for you to make the playoffs. I'm also a little bit of a skeptic. I need to see them win a series like this. I need to see them take 2 or 3 or sweep the Detroit Tigers. And then you look up and you're thinking, wow, hold on. The Royals are only a game back in the wild card and there's 30 games to play. Well, you absolutely can make the playoffs if that's the case. I think Royals fans are waiting for something seismic to happen. Something really, really surprising to get them to buy in fully to this year's squad.
Well, you're right on that point, and neither of us claim to be therapists, but that's exactly, in my opinion, what Royals fans do. It's incredibly annoying, but we do it. We're all guilty of it. And, you know, Josh Vernier, who's going to join us at 4, could tell you better than anyone, man, when the Royals give up a 2-run home run in the top of the second inning, the text line just floods with everyone needs fired. We're jumping off the bandwagon. It's football season. Well, they come back in the bottom of the 8th against a bad team like the White Sox, and all of a sudden the team's going to the World Series. No, we're very excited about this team. We're just putting up this facade, this front. Like you mentioned, we don't want to get hurt. We're going to be the first ones to say that it's going to fall apart so that when it does, we don't get hurt. But there is excitement about this team, and you're right about the timing of it sort of showing itself after this weekend. After this weekend, there's 25 games left. 6 of them are against the Angels, 3 against the A's, 3 against the Twins. These are winnable games down the stretch here, at least more losing teams than winning teams that are going to come across the Royals schedule in September. So, it's time to start winning against those good teams. It's time to take 2 out of 3 against the Tigers. But if they do, yeah, they're going to be fighting for headlines next week. I completely agree.
I think you'll be able to feel the momentum really shift if the Royals can really take advantage of this homestand. The Royals are 69-65. They're three games back, and they got a nine-game homestand. The Royals realistically need to win six of these next nine games. That's at a minimum. If you win less than that, then this dream probably dies. It's football season. Hey, you guys did the absolute best that you can, and let's move on. But if the Royals can win six or more of these games, then again, they really put themselves in a position that where I want them to be. I really want that series against Seattle to mean something. I want it to be meaningful. I want us to have to do the show outside of Kauffman Stadium on that Tuesday because the Royals are 1.5 games back of the team that's directly ahead of them. That starts with piece by piece, brick by brick. You got nine games at home. You got three games against a Tigers team that obviously poses a difficult challenge. They're one of the better teams in baseball. And then you got the Twins and the Angels, two bad teams. You got to take care of business. So maybe you don't win this series against the Tigers. That means you got to sweep one of those other two teams. You either got to sweep the Twins or you got to sweep the Angels. But you got to win at least six of these next nine in order to keep the dream alive of you having a chance to make the postseason.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right about the day-by-day, the brick-by-brick mentality. And schedule watching is never good, but we're getting into more math here. It's a big math show on this Friday. There's nine series left. All of them are three games except for the four-game set they have in Cleveland. If they win two games in each series, that's 18 more wins that puts you at 87. We think the benchmark is that 86-87 range. And for Seattle, if they go 14-14, they're an 86-win team. That's exactly 500. I think it'd be foolish to expect them to do less than that. So anytime you don't win two games in a series and therefore most of the time win that series, it's a missed opportunity and they do have to turn around and sweep. So the Tigers are better than you. I fully understand that. They did not look like a team that was in its own class above you last weekend when the Royals were in Detroit. The Royals had an opportunity to win all of those games, especially the one that I think was 3-2 late and the bullpen gave up a home run in the eighth. The Royals could have won 2 out of 3 last weekend as well, but it's time to stop saying they could have and time to go do it against a good team like the Tigers.
Let's get back to the top story in the NFL. We'll get back to college football here coming up in a bit as well and preview week one of the college football season. There's one thing that's kind of irked me a little bit over the last 12, 16 hours or so, however long it's been since the Micah Parsons trade. Jerry Jones feels like this is the modern day version of the Herschel Walker trade. That's what I was hearing. That's what he said. That's what the report said, that the Cowboys see this as a way to completely start over, to retool, to refresh. That Herschel Walker's trade was very, very instrumental in the Cowboys becoming a dynasty. That's how they got Darren Woodson. That's how they got Emmitt Smith. Like, they used those picks, those pieces, that ammunition to build the foundation of a dynasty. That's not what you got back in exchange for Micah Parsons. Sometimes I feel like people say things and then they act like we don't have Google, like we don't have a computer, like we can't look these things up for ourselves. The Cowboys got three first-round picks, three second-round picks, a third, and a sixth-round pick. Is that anywhere close to what they just got for Micah Parsons? Maybe I'm missing something, but there is not a single person. If you have listened to a podcast over the last 24 hours, if you have read an article, there has not been a single person who has been blown away by what the Cowboys have gotten in return. In fact, the Cowboys got less in return than what San Francisco gave up to move up to go get Trey Lance. They got less, in fact, than what the Raiders got back for trading Khalil Mack. To hell with the Herschel Walker trade. You didn't make the Khalil Mack trade. You didn't make the Trey Lance trade. So you're telling me that you think this is the Herschel Walker trade? This is that thing that creates the foundation that can... No, you didn't get anywhere close to the assets. I think this trade would have been received a little bit different if you had been blown away by the compensation. It's not bad that the Mavericks got back Anthony Davis in return, but there was a, is that it? Like, that sounds crazy to say for a future NBA Hall of Famer, but you didn't get nearly enough for Luka Doncic. And then to live in a city, to see that happen, to hear it, And then, I'm not saying you did the exact same thing, but to then also make a trade for a 26-year-old superstar who has had at least 12 sacks in every season that he has played, and for us to still be like, that's all you got? I think what you got was just quite simply the floor. You didn't get the ceiling, you got the floor. Two first-round picks is just, that's the standard if you're trading for a player like Micah Parsons. If you're trading for a top five defensive player, if you're trading for one of the best pass rushers in the league, the two first round picks, that at least gets me interested in answering the phone. If you're not offering that, we're not even having a conversation. I'm not just taking one first round pick. I need at least two. We're talking about an established player here. You gave up two first round picks and Kenny Clark? That was it? I bet the Packers had to put the phone on mute and turn around and say, is he serious? Yes, we'll take this deal. Maybe this doesn't end up working out for the Packers, but this was a swing that you had to take. This is nothing. The compensation is nothing. It honestly is nothing. This is equivalent to what the Chiefs gave up to go get Felix Onyedike and Xavier Worthy. Would you give up those two picks for the chance of getting Micah Parsons? Well, of course you would if you were the Green Bay Packers. This was a no-brainer to me for them. And the fact that Jerry is trying to spin this like some generational trade haul that they got, yes, that's what happened with Herschel Walker. And you got enough assets and enough picks and enough pieces that you could maneuver and you could build something with. Unless they have some gigantic plan that we just don't know about, and the Cowboys will prove themselves to be more apt in this than they've proven over the last 25 years, they're probably going to mess this up, whether they've messed up a lot of things over the last 25 years. We're going to continue to bounce back and forth. We got Vern coming up in about 45 minutes as we head out to Kauffman Stadium. We're going to talk some college football next with my guy Joe DeLeon. That's coming up. Keep it right here. It's The Drive on 96.5 The Fan. Welcome back into the show. Let me remind you that the sports talk here on The Fan is presented by Paramount Plus. You can't count on much these days, but you can always count on Sundays with the NFL on CBS and Paramount Plus. Watch your local NFL game every Sunday on CBS and also Paramount Plus all season long. Visit ParamountPlus.com/NFL to get started today. We are excited about week one of the NFL season. That is less than a week away. We get things going with the Cowboys and the Eagles. We're also excited about week one in college football. We got things going yesterday. Nebraska, they won an exciting game against Cincinnati. We got a handful of games coming up later today, and we got a great week one slate. Let's head to the phone lines right now to be joined by my guy, Joe DeLeon. He is the co-host of the Ruffino and Joe Show. Joe, happy to have you pop on today, man. Let's start with the marquee game of the weekend. Let's start with Texas and Ohio State. The line is actually moving a lot in this game. Who do you like on Saturday in Columbus?
Yeah, I think that this game between Texas and Ohio State, I think that this matchup, for me, I lean Texas. And I think that Texas has the one part for this game that Ohio State lacks that not enough people are talking about, and that's continuity at both coordinator spots. You have Chip Kelly, you have Jim Knowles moving on, going elsewhere. You're bringing in Brian Hartline back as the OC, and he's supposed to be the play caller this time around. And on top of this, you bring in a completely new DC and Matt Patricia. I think this team is going to be great, but to assume that they're going to hit the ground running so easily right off the bat against a really, really well-organized Texas team is expecting a lot. I think also where Texas has an advantage with these teams being evenly matched and also turning over a couple of important players from last year that left to go on to the NFL, Texas has a lot more depth on the interior of their defensive line. And I think that that depth is going to show up late in the game when they need it to. On top of this, there's a stark difference between the running back rooms between these two teams. I think that Ohio State's running back room with Peoples and with Donaldson, they're going to be a decent pairing this year. But they don't stack up to me with Trey Wisner and Cedric Baxter, who's coming back from the injury that he suffered last season and he missed the entire year. People forget that he was a former five-star that was super dynamic as a true freshman, and the NFL scouts love him as a potential high pick in the 2026 draft. So I think both those reasons for me, I'm taking Texas, and I'm also pushing Texas money line as one of my favorite bets this week. I think that those parts of this game are really, really going to show up.
You know that you and I also like to take a look at the gambling perspective of things. Are you surprised at how much movement we've seen? I feel like you can get it at Texas as a favorite, Ohio State as a favorite. This line has been anything but solid the last 48 hours. It now looks like Texas is a slight favorite. Are you surprised at the movement?
I'm not. And it's one of those things, and this is, I try not to fall victim to this when I place bets, because it's really like a superstition thing when we say this. But it always makes me feel super weird when a line moves this much, because it means everybody's betting in favor of said team. If everybody agrees, something's going to go amiss. Something's going to go wrong. But it doesn't surprise me, because I'm not the only college football expert or betting expert that's been pushing this. I've done a number of other national spots on betting outlets, and almost every single time there's agreement. There is total agreement. I have not had anybody push back on me on saying that I think Texas wins this game, and I'm putting money down on Texas to win the game. And because of that, that has turned into this result where the line has moved as much as it has.
Right now, we're talking to Joe DeLeon, just taking a closer look at week one of the college football season. Let's talk about Arch Manning. My big theme for this week in college football is answering questions. There's a lot of big questions in college football. Can Alabama bounce back? How good is Arch Manning? What about Bill Belichick in year one at UNC? The fact that Arch Manning, who has been the most discussed, most hyped, most sought-after prospect in college football the last handful of years, the fact that he makes his de facto debut. I know he played against Mississippi State and Louisiana Monroe or one of those kind of teams on the road against the Horseshoe in the most watched game in college football for the week. That's your official debut in college football. The fact that that happens on the road at Ohio State against a team of that caliber, I just don't know what to expect from Arch. You could tell me that he throws for 180 yards, one touchdown, and one interception. You could tell me that he throws for three touchdowns and runs for another. I don't know how you can be surprised at any outcome today.
Yeah, I don't think you should be surprised by any outcome, but Carrington, I have to sadly admit, I am one of the idiots that is aggressively buying into Arch Manning to have not only a tremendous season this year, but also a tremendous first game against Ohio State. I don't know what it is about this kid, and I'm not saying this because his last name is Manning, but I don't know what it is about him where he gives off this vibe that I think he's the type of player that thrives in attention. There's a lot of athletes and there's a lot of quarterbacks who I think are the opposite. But really simple example, Nico last year, it felt like the more attention he was getting, the worse he was playing, and he didn't play up the expectation. I think Arch is the opposite here, where he just has been waiting and waiting and waiting and preparing and being patient. And now is his chance to prove to everybody that he's more than just the Manning name. He is a kid who has been around football all of his life. He's got this cerebral, natural ability to play the game. I know that we have such a small sample size of film, and I think that this plays to why I'm so excited about him. People use the argument of, oh, he barely played and he had turnovers in those games. That's not enough to go off of to say that he's going to be good. If anything, it's a bit problematic. I think it's the opposite. If we dig into the film and we see some of the tremendous throws that he was able to show, the touch, the timing, just the easy decision-making despite having so few reps, that's what gets me excited. I think that as the season progresses and he gets more chances out there, in more tense situations, he is going to make bigger and bigger plays. For as little time he has been playing college football and as few reps he has taken in this sport, he was not supposed to be able to make some of the throws that he did last year. So I'm buying in blindly. I think that this is going to pan out. I do not think this is going to be a circumstance where Arch goes on to be disappointing.
From an Ohio State perspective, I mean, there's no team that lost as much talent as they did last year. Still very talented, but they lost a lot via the draft and graduation. How do you feel like they've replenished that talent in Columbus?
Well, and this applies for Texas as well, but the replenishing aspect is that Ryan Day has recruited an arsenal of former five-stars at so many positions. So Jeremiah Smith isn't the only true freshman that is on this team from last year's recruiting class. There are a lot of guys on this roster that have been waiting for their chance to play. There's two guys in particular that I think of that aren't household names that I think will be by the end of the season. Kenyatta Jackson, who is one of their defensive ends, who played very sparingly, But in the sparing reps that he was given last year, rotating in behind JTT and Jack Sawyer, he did some amazing things. He really showed that he is a tremendous athlete that could end up being a riser as a college football player and as an NFL draft prospect. And then the other player, Brandon Innes, has been making a lot of waves in Ohio State circles, and I think is going to be a national name known as a wide receiver in the country, because we already know that defenses are going to be so aggressive to slow down Jeremiah Smith. They're also going to be careful about not allowing Carnell Tate to completely kick their butts. And I think teams are smart enough to be aware of Max Clair, who is the transfer that came in from Purdue, that's the most talented tight end in the country. I think that something like Brandon Innes is a great example of how there are all these former five stars that can just step in and ball. This Ohio State team is one of the recent examples of teams, like a couple of the top premier programs in college football, that aren't over-committing to digging into the transfer portal to build their rosters. They will have a really talented core of guys that they've been developing, and then when the transfer portal opens up, they'll go and grab an edge rusher, they'll go and grab a tight end, and then they'll go to work once the offseason comes around.
The marquee game in the evening is LSU and Clemson. I really like LSU's team this year. I actually like LSU more than I like Clemson, but there's two things to me that are at play here that I cannot pick LSU. Number one, this game is on the road at night. You never pick against a team at home at night, certainly not with the home field advantage that Clemson has as an organization, as a program. And I'm picking LSU in week one of the college football season. That also just seems like a really bad idea. I think you got to pick Clemson in this one.
I absolutely agree with you on that part. And I don't want to fall for the trap that a lot of times, just in picking games and placing bets, that if someone's eventually going to be due, you think that eventually Brian Kelly would break through and win one of these big opening week games. But I don't think that's going to happen in this. And the really specific reason is I think along the lines of scrimmage, we're going to see a separation. Not a big one, but a late game scenario where we watch Clemson's defensive line take advantage of LSU's very green offensive line. A lot of those offensive linemen from last year for LSU, one of the best offensive lines in college football last season, it had Will Campbell and it had all of those dudes that got drafted. They are resetting. They are going to have to figure out what their chemistry is. It is a position group that requires, and we've already kind of saw this on Thursday night with a lot of these teams that we had high hopes for, to have high-flying offenses, we're starting to see that there is a feeling-out period for offensive line units figuring out how to play with one another. First game of doing that, I don't want to be doing that on the road at Clemson of all places against a defensive line unit that has T.J. Parker, who's going to be a top-10 pick, Peter Woods, who could be a top-10 pick, Devontae Capehart, who's a defensive tackle, who could be a top-75 pick, and Will Helt, who could also be a top-75 pick. They're loaded with NFLers, and on top of this, Tom Allen is the right defensive coordinator to get the most out of this unit that disappointed at times last year. So that is just the biggest part. Lines of scrimmage is always going to be the easiest talking point for a week one game when we have some uncertainties on how we expect teams to perform.
One thing that stands out to me, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, is Clemson just hasn't really fared very well against non-ACC teams the last handful of years. I think about last season. They got blown out in that first game of the year by Georgia. We found out Georgia was good, but maybe not the Georgia that they had been the previous 2-3 years or so. They also lost at the end of the season to South Carolina. So, like, if this game was played at a neutral site, you could really convince me for LSU. I would probably pick LSU in that scenario. But just, I got questions, serious questions about both of these teams heading into this season.
And I think, though, the one counter I would provide to that, because you do bring up a good point. Clemson has been disappointing recently. But I think that we got to dig a little bit deeper into the fact that Clemson's disappointing seasons over the past couple of years have just been derived by the fact that they've been some of Dabo Sweeney's worst rosters. And I was a big critic of Dabo for how he handled his roster building over the last few years. I think a big reason why they sunk too is that they did not have an effective plan at bringing in the right quarterbacks, and that kind of led to the whole DJU fiasco. But I digress. the whole big part with this team going into this year is that they had a lot of young guys that were important for them winning the ACC championship last year that are now going to be upperclassmen. This team is very different than the one that struggled against Georgia. It is battle-tested. It is prepared to win at home against a team like LSU. So I think that this season is really going to be different. It's a big reason why I've been backing Clemson and a lot of these Clemson players to have massive 2025 seasons.
Joe, do you like LSU to make the college football playoff? I asked that question because their schedule is tough. Like, I'm not sure if there is a team in the country that has a much more difficult schedule than the Tigers. Do you have them as a playoff team?
So this is a very, very loaded conversation because for those who might have missed this, the college football playoff announced that they're adjusting their approach to evaluating teams that deserve to get into the college football playoff. They're emphasizing more, after all the criticism that they got last year, wins against marquee opponents, and they're going to reevaluate losses against certain teams. So strength of schedule now is going to matter even more. And I bring this up to say, you just mentioned the difficult schedule. LSU has one of the hardest schedules in college football this season. I think that there's a realistic world, and last year this wouldn't have come to fruition whatsoever because we had three teams that this applied to. I think that there's a world that LSU goes 9-3, and they're one of the last teams that gets in. I think that with the schedule that they have, it will set them up, as long as they don't get blown out in some of these difficult games they have, whether maybe it's against Alabama or it's against Clemson, as long as they're all close losses, I think that there is a very strong opportunity for them to pull out a couple of big wins, to have one of the best resumes in college football, but a 9-3 record that will justify them getting in. I think that we're going to potentially see a complete shift in how the committee approaches putting teams into the playoff field. And I think that we're probably going to see less of the teams that are like SMU getting into the mix, maybe even a team like Indiana getting pushed out if a team like LSU does end up going 9-3. But I think it's also accomplishable to that point for them to go 10-2 and to secure a spot as well.
Let's talk about Alabama and Florida State. It is so weird to say this, but there is a lot of pressure on Alabama. They always say you don't want to be the guy that replaces the guy. Alabama had a couple uncharacteristic losses last year. They missed the college football playoff. They head into another difficult season. This maybe isn't a team that is as loaded as some Alabama teams in years past. It's so crazy to think for a team that could go 10-3, 9-4, it's going to be a lot of pressure on Kalen DeBoer heading into year three if they don't make the college football playoff this season.
Yeah, and I think that the pressure has also built up because surprisingly and suddenly over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of driving force for Alabama to be considered to be one of the best teams in the country that will finish the year atop the SEC as one of the highest ranked teams in the college football playoff. And the buzz almost seems random. I think it's justified, but it seems random. Nobody was really talking about them at the beginning of the offseason, and it just kind of propped up recently as this, you know, this dark horse to surprise everybody. I think where the hype comes from is, one, Ryan Grubb comes back. There's less off of, or when I say comes back, he rejoins Kalen DeBoer, who was the offensive coordinator for when Washington went on their title run that they did. It takes less off of Kalen DeBoer's plate, and I think it's going to activate a lot for Ty Simpson. There are a lot of high expectations for Simpson, who's been around for a very long time and has been able to digest and improve sitting behind Jalen Milroe. But where the talent of this team needs to be recognized the most is that they've got a very gifted offensive line that was very young last year, that was really inconsistent, that I think is going to take a step forward. They have a defensive line that applies in that same exact area. There's some injuries on that defensive line with Tim Keenan, but James Smith is super gifted. There's a linebacker room's athletic, and their secondary is super, super explosive. There is a lot of athleticism in that secondary that I think can really produce some game-altering plays with picks and pass deflections in key situations. So that's where the hype is coming from. And you, like you said, you don't want to be the guy to replace the guy. It was hard last year. It was hard to get guys to buy in his first year. And you saw the translation to where there were a lot of silly mistakes, a lot of penalties, just a lot of late-game mental lapses that really, really hurt them. I think that this is going to be a very different year for Alabama. I just can't get all the way there with them winning the SEC in 2025.
That is my guy, Joe DeLeon. Be sure to check him out. He is the co-host of the Ruffino and Joe Show, one of my favorite people to talk college football with. Just want to help get you guys ready for week one of the college football season. Speaking of week one of the college football season, I saw some people debating this, and I just want to weigh in. I want to give my thoughts. You guys know that Dylan Raiola, the very talented quarterback from Nebraska, he's a big fan of Patrick Mahomes. Considers him to be an idol, consider him to be a mentor. He is a fan. And I think Mahomes has kind of taken a liking to it. I mean, he was in the locker room during the AFC Championship celebration. Like, Mahomes and him have a relationship with each other. And you guys know, obviously, he's a big fan, and he kind of copies a lot of Mahomes stuff, right? And I saw people very split on, is this cool? Is this not cool? Is this creepy? Hey, he was a kid coming up. It's okay to have an idol. It's okay. All of that makes sense to me. To me, where I think that Dylan Raiola is a little bit off is he doesn't seem to have his own personality. His personality seems to be Patrick Mahomes' personality. You guys remember that scene in the movie Coming to America where Eddie Murphy's about to get married and he's talking to Vanessa Bell Calloway, her character, and he's like, well, what are you like? And she's like, well, whatever it is you like. And he's like, no, I know what I like. I want to know what you like. Whatever it is you like. And they just kept going back and forth. It's actually a very funny part of the movie. If you've ever seen Coming to America, that's how Dylan Raiola is. I don't think people really give him a hard time for having a favorite player and doing some of the things. It's almost like he has taken everything that we know about Patrick Mahomes' personality and tried to incorporate it into his life. His look, his hairstyle, his glasses, his mannerisms. He's even doing the little finger thing. What are we doing? You guys know the finger thing I'm talking about with Mahomes. Mahomes completes a pass or throws an incompletion. He just starts doing that little finger fluttering thing. I don't know what it is. He's doing that now. Everything that we know about Mahomes, you have just now taken his whole persona and tried to make it yours. That's what the rest of us think is a little bit weird. That's it. I understand. You're 19, 20. I'm not here to be too hard on a teenager. And I get it. We all wanted to copy somebody. You maybe bought shoes because of another person, or you liked a certain kind of music, or whatever it is. Like, we all have been influenced at one point. I never tried to, like, make my entire personality 50 cents. That's weird. That's the part that's weird to me about this whole thing with Dylan Raiola. You don't have any of your own. Like, who were you in high school? I can't fully wrap my head around. I mean, I'm rooting for the kid. I really am rooting for the kid. I think he's good. I think he can play. I want him to just get some of your own things. Something. Like, Kobe eventually found his own thing. Yeah, he copied a lot of Mike's game, but like the Mamba mentality, like, you kind of found your own lane. You haven't found any of it. Word for word, bar for bar, you just copy Patrick Mahomes. Come on now, like, that can't be the move. Somebody's got to tell you. You got to create your own personality. You got to separate yourself in some way. Coming up in 20 minutes, we'll be joined by Josh Vernier, our Royals insider. That's all coming up. Keep it right here. So drive. All right. This segment is going to be just a collection of random thoughts that I've accumulated over the last 24 hours. I'll share them with you, and then we'll be joined by Josh Vernier. So if you guys will indulge me for just a little bit. I was thinking this randomly as I was watching the Cincinnati-Nebraska game. Patrick Mahomes was 13 years old when Taylor Swift made Love Story. Like, you know the song I'm talking about, you know? Like, you know the song. Can you imagine if you had told a 13-year-old Patrick Mahomes, that I'm sure was listening to this on the radio, if you had told him, hey, you know what? One day you're going to be in her wedding. Like, you're not going to be the one getting married to her. You're just going to be in the wedding. I wonder what 13-year-old Patrick Mahomes would have told you. Like, just think about that. Like, that's the way your life turned out. Hey, this person on the radio that has this really catchy tune, you're going to become pretty good friends with her. One day, you're going to be close enough to her and her fiance that you're going to be in their wedding one day. Like, how do you think about that? I wish we could go back in time and figure that out. I was thinking that because, you know, she was at the Nebraska-Cincinnati game, and, I mean, I get it. They kept showing her, and they kept zooming in on the ring. And at one point, even I was like, bro, I don't care about this. Let's keep going. But, you know, it was like I had to calm myself down. I was like, you know what? I get it. I understand. You know, this is Nebraska Cincinnati at 9:30 on ESPN. I mean, I understand why they're showing Taylor Swift. I get it. It was more than they do during an NFL game. It really was. During an NFL game, they kind of got a little bit of a formula now. You know, they'll show her for a big play, or they'll show her for a touchdown, and they were just showing them sitting in the booth, just regular. Like, we're showing Taylor, she's off in the back talking to other people. Travis is on his phone. Why are we missing the second down play to see this? So that was one thought that I had randomly as I was watching the game. I just want to know what he would think in that scenario. I also was thinking this. Yesterday's game, the game between Nebraska and Cincinnati, is the perfect example that everything in college athletics is for sale. Think about this. Cincinnati was supposed to be at home. It was a home game for them. They then sold the home game to Indianapolis. Now, Indianapolis is a reasonable drive for Cincinnati. I think it's like 2.5-3 hours. I mean, Nebraska fans also would have showed up, but you would have had a good portion of Cincinnati fans that made the trip. The Chiefs then swooped in and said, well, they're offering you $2 million. We can get you probably close to six between tickets and venue, and we can get you close to six. Cincinnati had a home game against Nebraska. They then essentially sold it to Nebraska. Now, come on. I can look at a map. I could have told Cincinnati, hey, you're not going to have a lot of fans there. Kansas City and Lincoln are 3 hours apart from each other. They're coming, and they're coming in big numbers. You took a game that was very drivable for your fan base and sold it, essentially. You basically bought a loss. You were not winning that game. Cincinnati is not the kind of program that is winning road games against Nebraska. I'm sorry, there is not. You had a home game. You then sold your home game to Nebraska. Because we all knew the moment that that game got introduced, Nebraska fans were going to do exactly what they did. They bought up all the tickets. They bought up your tickets. Nebraska sold out Arrowhead by themselves, essentially, yesterday, and probably could have kept bringing people. They could play a second game in Kansas City, and they would get the same number of people to come back. The fact that you did that, you sold a home game is what you did. That's what you did. You sold one of your home games. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but you know what? Hey. I'm going to tell you this, Nathan. Now, people think I'm crazy when I say this. I don't think that college football is a better product than the NFL. Of course it's not, right? I love the way that the NFL is packaged. Like, it's packaged perfectly. At noon, you get these 8 games that you're kind of interested in them, but you know what? We're going to throw it all in the pot, and we're going to cook up something great for you on Red Zone. I do not watch standalone games at noon anymore. Unless it's a big-time game that, you know, late in the season, they end up just being off on a team, and then at noon, it's like two, you know, really good teams, and they can't really move it. They can't flex it. It can't be the 3:25 game. I can't remember the last time, for a non-Chiefs game, watching it for work, that I just, at 12 o'clock, I'm just watching Fox, and I'm not watching Red Zone. I can't do it. 3:25, it's a little bit different. That's usually a game you really want to see. That's Bills and Ravens. That's Chiefs and Bengals. Yeah, I'm watching the 3:25 game, and usually by that point, all the good games are off Red Zone. Then it's those random West Coast games. You know the ones. It's like Arizona's on and the Raiders are on. Like, I don't need the sound for Red Zone for that. I'm okay. I'm all right. And then you got Sunday Night Football, etc. What I love so much about college football is you just get absolutely overloaded in every single window. Think about week one of the college football season. At 11 o'clock, you have probably the best game of the day between Texas and Ohio State. That's the number one and number two ranked teams in the coaches poll. Texas is the number one team in both polls. Ohio State's the defending national champion. That's the game you first get when you wake up. And that's opposite Tennessee and Syracuse that I actually think can be a good competitive game. I mean, it's not getting main TV love. It'll get that second TV. I'll show it a little love. So then when that game goes off, You then head right into Alabama and Florida State. And this isn't even one of those, you know, Jerry World specials. You know, they love to play one of those neutral site games down in Dallas. No, this game is actually at Florida State. So it's going to be a great environment, great crowd. It's going to be a lot of fun. Alabama on the road against Florida State. That's the 2:30 window. And then at night, you get LSU and Clemson. And then there's a bunch of other games. And then just what I love about it is very different than the NFL. You don't need Sunday ticket or any extra package to really enjoy college football. Think about when it's really humming. You get games on ESPN, ESPN2, ESPNU, SEC Network, ABC, Fox, all at the exact same time. All you got to do is be quick enough on the remotes to get everything going at one time. That's not how the NFL is. That's not how it's packaged unless you have Sunday ticket. I really love that aspect of it. I love how you can sit down on the couch on a Saturday and you can basically just watch everything right there from your basic television package. That's a big plus to me for college football.
Well, I think Red Zone is the only thing that's like that in terms of the chaos, except as you mentioned, the Red Zone is usually featuring the Saints and the Dolphins and the Giants and the Browns. So it's games you don't really care about and you're watching them for the format. Man, college football, not only this weekend, I'm looking at, I think it's week 9 or 10, the first weekend in November. Man, you've got like 6 matchups against ranked teams. It's Penn State, Ohio State, Miami, SMU, Texas Tech, Kansas State, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Georgia, Florida, on down the line. These are days where you put TV1 on Fox, TV2 on ESPN, you kick your feet up, and I'll see you tomorrow. I see what you're saying about that format and the packaging of college football. Obviously, it's not as good of a product as the NFL, but again, I'm watching Red Zone because of the formatting, not because of the actual substance. Man, these football games are good all day long in college football.
The last random thought that I had that I want to share with you is that Jerry Jones is really the worst kind of combination of leader. He is a mediocre, stubborn person. I imagine a lot of the people that we talk about are actually really stubborn. Like, something tells me that Patrick Mahomes is really stubborn. You know, I'm just going to guess. Like, we've kind of seen, hey, you should go get an MRI. No, I'm not getting an MRI. You know, I just assume that's part of his personality. It's hard to be as great as he is without having a little bit of that tendency. But you know what you're usually willing to put up with it? Because you're really, really good. You know, the worst kind of people in this aspect are really stubborn, mediocre people. Hey, man, that doesn't work. You know what you're talking about? Yes, it does. I'm trying to tell you that that's probably not going to work. The Cowboys have been mediocre for 25 years, and Jerry is still so hell-bent on doing it. It's my way or the highway. That's the worst kind of leadership quality you can have. Nobody is saying that it has to be ultra-collaborative. You ultimately are the one paying for everything. You're the owner. You definitely get a voice in things, but we see a lot of organizations where, yes, the owner gets an input, but the owner is not the end-all, be-all. And one of the problems for the Cowboys is they don't have anybody that can stand up to Jerry Jones. Look at the last 20 years of coaches that they've had. Dave Campo, Chan Gailey, Jason Garrett, McCarthy. It's clear that Jerry is an alpha. He is a wolf. And any time that he has been around other wolves or hired them as head coaches, he has always felt threatened because they want credit for the success. I'm watching this Cowboys documentary. There's basically an entire episode of Jerry doesn't feel like Jimmy did this. Jimmy doesn't feel like Jerry did this. So they just argue about it. And ultimately, you're thinking, why does it matter? Aren't you guys working on the same team? Aren't you guys like, why is it so important for you, for us to think that you did this thing and not the other person? They're two really stubborn people. But Jimmy was really good at what he did, and he had that sounding board that Jerry could never really go off the rails. There's not another team in the NFL that would have hired Brian Schottenheimer. Not another one. Think about that. They're America's team. No other team was interested in your head coach but you. No one else would have interviewed him. He would not be a head coach in the league. That's who you hired. And then before you even let him coach a game, you traded his best player. You couldn't do that with certain head coaches who have a little bit of pull, who have some gravitas, who could push back on you. And that's kind of why the Cowboys are the Cowboys. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll be joined by Vern. Keep it right here. It's The Drive.